the five common mistakes that beginners make.
The painting is very important, but I think the building and cleaning is on par.
I'll tell you now, I never once put an extra purity seal on a model. Not once. It stands out as a mistake for me. It's because it was something that I just never even addressed as a mistake.
It will seriously give you problems down the line if you don't do it right from day one.
I was so obsessed with blending as smooth as possible that I would kill all of the contrast on my models.
When you hear different people's painting situations and then you see how good they are at painting, it will make you realise, oh, what am I doing?
You heard about the new Golden Demon categories?
Yes, yeah.
I have, yes.
It's all talk of the town this week in the hobby space.
Yeah, it's a bit of a shake-up, isn't it?
It's exciting, I think.
Should we read them off? So, for those who don't know, Golden Demon rules for Adepticon 2024 have been announced. Mm-hmm. And there's some changes to some of the categories, and there's some new ones. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit of a mix, really. You've got some categories that have been consolidated into just one, and they've got some that used to be just one, broken down into multiple. So, category list for Adepticon 24 is for 40k, single miniature, unit or kill team. So that used to be just unit or squad, sorry. We've got Warhammer 40,000, large model or vehicle. Then for AOS, single miniature, unit or Warcry warband. So that's now one category. Large model or war machine for AOS as well. Then Middle-earth has got its own category, as it always has. Horus Heresy has now got its own category as an umbrella category. Underworld's own category. Necromunda got its own category. Blood Bowl has got its own category. Epic Scale has got its own category. Then there's Youngbloods and Open, which is the same as before. And now Diorama and Jewel are one category.
Yeah, it is. Where to start, really? I think it's obviously they've released the category list and they haven't released, as far as I'm aware, the rules.
I don't think the new rules pack's been released yet.
So the rules pack hasn't been released. So we've been told the category list and not the rules. So it's hard to know exactly what they're angling for with certain things. But it seems to me like how do you... It seems like they're just giving themselves a bit more freedom to go, oh, I feel like that actually fits into this other category.
Yeah, because, there is that, yeah.
Because there's so many models now that could fit into a few different categories, if that makes sense. Mm. Like a Necromunda single model or whatever is still a 40K single model. Or like within Necromunda now, is the rules pack for Necromunda going to be that it needs to be a full team? Or is that going to include single miniatures as well? The ones about the games, like the Underworlds, Necromunda, Blood Bowl, just seem so like open to me at the minute. Like they, I don't know what their rules are going to be.
I think it's a bit of a test, really. And I think number one, I think it's actually quite good that they're marrying a lot of the game systems. I think because if you only say paint Warcry, or if you paint Underworlds or whatever, you might not be so inclined to want to go into the Fantasy Squad category or the Age of Sigmar category, perhaps.
Because it's so stacked.
Yeah. So having your own category for the models that you love and for the game system you play, it maybe reduces the barrier to entry a little bit for people, potentially, which is another way to look at it. I think that, obviously, GD's been going for a long time. The categories are obviously grown and diversified as the years have passed and things have moved around. We've had changes throughout the competition through the years that I've been into it and through I've known of it. I think it is actually quite good that certain game systems, because the thing is, I know you could argue, well, a Terminator Praetor is very similar to a Terminator Captain from 40K, and I know that, but I think that it's not so much on the specific model. I think it's more on the narrative of the IP of the game, and they're wanting to create a category for each of the different game systems, which makes sense. It's like, for example, the Epic one, you can put in old retro metal epic models, you can put in Adeptus Titanicus, you can put in Battlefleet Gothic, you can put in like loads of different models from loads of different ranges, which is good. And I think it gives someone who potentially just paints X game system the opportunity to go, well, I have something for me now. It's just giving that diversity of game system in the competition.
So do you think, for example, I mean, it's all guesswork, isn't it? But do you think someone who wants to enter a single model that's from Underworlds, for example, surely that will get pushed into AOS single
potentially,
figure,
but they
don't, rather than being in the Underworlds category, which seems more like if you're Warband. Giving a whole category to a game that has small squads,
yeah,
surely the
that's the thing though, because you've got some of these game systems are broader than others, right? So Necromunda having its own category, the Necromunda range is much more compressed in what's within it. But if you look at like Chorus Heresy, that's anything from a full-size Titan to a Mark IV Marine.
Yeah,
whereas if you look at Necromunda, it's mostly warbands of a similar size, right?
I think because obviously, again, at the time of recording this, I haven't seen the new rules for it. But I think once the rules are released and the clarifications are released, I think it will qualm a lot of people's reservations if they've got any. I think that your thing is if you don't diversify and try new things, it will stagnate over time, I think.
I think it's cool on the whole. Like,
there's so many categories now as well. It gives you so many more opportunities to enter.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah. I think because at Fest... I think there's like 1,000 entries. I don't know what exactly the number was, but I think it was the most entries I've ever seen at Golden.
We've
Demon.
All guessed roughly 1,000.
Yeah,
right?
it was like the most entries I've ever seen. And I think that shows how far the interest in GD and the amount of people that are improving as a painter to want to enter or pushing themselves to enter competitions. That shows how much it's grown over the last, 3 years, even with lockdown and pandemic and stuff. So I think a rejigging of categories and also opening up of different things has kind of always kind of been on the horizon, I think, with the way that things have happened.
If single figures are allowed in some of these broken down categories, I'm intrigued to see if 40K single fig remains the toughest
I think it will, because when you look at it, so 40K single fig, historically, I'm not some big like GD buff or anything, but I wouldn't assume that a lot of, say, like Necromunda models, I wouldn't say Necromunda made up a lot of
percentage of entries.
Real estate in the single fig 40K.
But do you think that's because it didn't have its own category before?
Well, no, I'm saying like, because I don't think I would have seen loads. So I don't think, and Necromunda is that the only one that's 40K based that's separated?
Well, looking at last year's categories, I think like all the smaller game systems like Necromunda and that basically went into the 40K categories.
That's what I'm saying. So, and I don't think that made up a huge percentage of the single fig 40K.
But do you think that's because they didn't think they could get a look in because that model compared to a 40K model wouldn't compete as well?
I don't know.
See much Necromunda.
I don't know. I think it's probably just because if you're going to paint a single figure from 40K, you're going to pick a 40K model.
Yeah,
not that it doesn't happen, and there's some really cool models in those other game systems. The one that it benefits most from, I think, is I've always banged on about how the Underworlds models are so cool.
Yeah, they are good.
So if you can do a single, I think you'd find more people wanting to enter a single Underworlds model into AOS single figure. I don't know whether they're going to be allowed to do that now.
I don't think it will be. I think Underworlds will be the full warband. I think that in my mind, that's the way I would read it. Purely because if they are going down the line of by game system, if you think of it that way, for me that would mean that specifically for that category that you would have to paint the warband, which does make.
But the only thing that's missing then, if I look at that, is Horus Heresy has its own cat, whereas it used to be Horus Heresy squad was in 40K squad.
Yeah.
So that would mean in terms of warbands, you could have one from every single game system as a squad in its own category other than Horus Heresy.
So essentially there's like six squad cats basically.
Yeah, but I'm saying the interesting thing is that would be
Horus Heresy,
right?
But that, look, they obviously do it by interest in the game system. Like that's why Middle Earth is all in it on its own as well. Like that's not, there's not Middle Earth.
That's a really good point.
What was there last year for Middle Earth?
Last year was just the same scenario of Middle Earth.
Just a Middle Earth. Yeah.
So this is the thing. So like, I'm trying to scratch my brain and remember, but the last couple of times I've looked in the Middle Earth category at Fest and also at the GD that was at Warhammer World, and thinking right back to other even ones that were in Coventry back, before pandemic and stuff, I don't remember whether there were four units or if it was just single figures. I think in Lord of the Rings, it was just single figures, but I think that wasn't a stipulation of the category. I think that was
just what people did.
I think that's the case, yeah.
So that could point to previous Middle Earth categories then, rules-wise, could point towards what they're going to do for Underworld's category, Necromunda category, Blood Bowl category. It's interesting, though, because I obviously someone's going to turn up with a jewel based on Blood Bowl or something. That's obviously going to get put in the jewel diorama.
I would guess so.
Well,
yeah.
that's the elephant in the room. Well, this is jewel and diorama are now one category.
Yeah, so let's talk about that then.
I know, like, for example, like Mark Lifton, someone I know, like he's like prolific at jewels. That's like his thing. He loves a good jewel. And and he's won loads, obviously, for how skilled and talented he is. But the thing is like the duel obviously is quite focused. And obviously that's the one that I won my one with in 2018. Like it's just two models obviously facing off. Whereas obviously a diorama is that, but magnified. But it doesn't really hang on the interaction as much. I would say it's more about the scene. So from a judging perspective, you're then going to be judging against the composition of the piece, how the models will interact with each other and the overall look of it. And then you're going to be judging almost that, but really granular between two models. I don't think from a judging perspective, I know a lot of people love Jewel and love Diorama separately as their things. But I think from a judging perspective, there's not really too much difference in the way that you would look at those two things in my mind. Because there's still arguably a scene with models involved engaging each other or doing something. You might have a couple of guardsmen standing by a tank, like not doing anything.
It does depend on the model, though, because interestingly, the one they've used for the cover is the Bard's Revenge model. Yeah. And that's basically...
That is basically a jewel.
You think of it as a single fig, right? But it's a jewel.
No. But I'm saying even as a jewel, that I don't think of as a diorama.
No.
Like, some jewels, you could argue, are like diorama-esque. They're on a big base.
I think this is the thing.
I think that's part of it is that over the years, last few years, the lines have been blurred a little bit between.
I think
the two
in every
categories.
Category, everything's getting more and more diorama. Even like single fig, even squad. Now everything's on like one big scenic base. I'm guilty of that, obviously, but
yeah, I guess so. I mean, look, but then you say that, but then one of the most prolific winner, Angelo Di Cello, is classic gaming base on a plinth. You know, like, and he's got more.
I don't think we're not necessarily saying, oh, you need to do that to win.
No, but what I'm saying
in terms of entries, that seems to be the trend. You're seeing more and more and more in terms of percentage of entries. Things are leaning.
Yeah, you are.
I'm not saying you have to do that to win.
No, you obviously don't. No, but that's the same thing with like saying, oh, you have to do NMM to win. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, it's, you know, like, it's all about how well the model's painted, plus all the other factors that they look at, you know, the quality of the build, you know, all those kind of things, like all the things that they look for. I don't think there's like a linear path. Like they even say it, like it's not even about heavy metal style. Like a lot of people used to think that it's just, oh, you've got to paint heavy metal style.
I agree with all those factors. I'm just saying, if you look at the plethora of entries that you see, you do notice trends and people are.
Oh, yeah, we're talking more about that. Like, just the fact that things are.
That's what's popular.
Things are blurring towards being a diorama in every category. And the most of that was definitely jewel. Like there was somewhere. You had to like think a minute to tell what the jewel actually was. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
stuff
no,
like
I get
that.
What you mean.
So, and it just looked more like a diorama. But
I think amalgamating is a good thing. I genuinely do. As much as I know that it probably people who really like entering jewel like as an individual category, it's going to be frustrating. But
there's going to be like individual cases in there that are going to be probably some upsets. But I'd say generally on the whole, I'm inclined to agree with you.
Your jewel that you won with.
Yeah.
Would you, ignoring this, ignoring the categories being smashed together, would you look at it and think, oh, it's diorama?
Well, it's still a scene. It's still an environment with models engaging each other. The only real difference between a jewel and maybe a diorama is the number of models that are actually on that. Obviously, a jewel has to be 1v1 typically. Yeah, like that's when you see most, that's what most jewels are. So really, when you strip it right back to the core basics of what that thing is, it's an environment.
It is a diorama,
with models engaging. And models, it's still plural because there's two for a duel, but is there really that much difference between...
You could argue that it gives you more freedom on your duels, that you can add a few extra things in or...
Well, yeah, because it could...
That's a good point, actually.
It could mean that, like, you have one marine against three orcs or four orcs or something like that. So it's still a duel to an extent, but it just makes more of it. I think what it does is it broadens the boundaries of what painters can do for an entry. I think that's something that in my mind it does. And I understand, yeah, the 1v1s are really focused, really sort of like Ribena strength kind of look at...
Ribena strength.
We're kicking it off. How long are we in?
We are 15 minutes in.
15 minutes in, Robina Strength.
Sorry.
There's your Jamesism for the
episode. I'm very sorry.
Well, it's fine. You should... yeah. Should we segue that into the viewers' comments then? Because I found this interesting. JP Kimball 9479 says, I think on the back of your Siege Studios t-shirts, you should have all of the phrases that James says on them.
Talking about the t-shirts.
We'll take that. Where, did you not get the memo, George?
Yeah, I didn't get the memo. Come on, like, still waiting on my merch pack.
Didn't get the memo. Didn't get any t-shirts.
Yeah. We'll have to sort that, won't we? Yeah. I will take that into consideration. We might do a limited run with some isms on it. Yeah. So,
it's like the podcast edition of the t-shirt. It's just got quotes from James.
Yeah. No one will have a clue what you're wearing.
I really want to, like, I wish I could have some sort of insight into your brain. Like, They're so off the cuff. They're mental things you've never heard. It's not like he's like parroting like classic phrases.
There are some classic ones that do come out now and again, but I don't...
Generally speaking, just like, throughout the day, you'll just say something like that, just nonchalant.
The ones that... Did you know what the interesting thing is? The classic ones are the ones that you sort of pause and think about and then you come out with. Like the ones that anyone says. And then the ones that just roll out of your mouth are the most insane, like, ones that no one's ever heard of.
I showed you that model this morning. I went, how'd you like that, Kipper? He was like, what the hell are you talking about?
Right. Thank you all in the comments for coming through for me on the last episode, because the support for the refreshers was frankly overwhelming.
Right. I want to get some... Go on, read your comment.
Well,
read your little stupid little comment.
My little propaganda.
he's trying to swerve it here in his favour. But I think Joe's got something that ruins that quite quickly.
Well, Amy Snuggs, member of the team at Siege, says, I'm with you, George. Love some refreshers. Always get a big bag of retro sweets every Christmas from my nan-in-law. One of the best presents ever. So that is exactly on brand what I said about the Christmas box.
Right. That does sound lovely. And that is very nice. I put a poll out about this. I put R refreshers an S tier suite as a grown adult.
I don't like that you put at the end of that as a grown adult, because you're implying that you're stupid. You've intentionally phrased your poll to get people into the mindset of guilting themselves for liking refreshers.
That was the question, though. I was saying it for children, maybe. For like little, stupid little kids, maybe. No, so, but
The general consensus,
I hate to say it, George, it was a landslide victory to no. 76% of people voted no. It's not S tier as an adult. 24% of people voted yes, and one of those people was George.
Trying to sway the numbers there, George, a little bit.
Someone messaged me saying it's not even S tier as a kid. So they they're saying even as a child.
I think you're getting too caught up on the where you're ranking it. That's down to personal taste. But whether or not it's acceptable to eat as an adult is undeniably...
Although, again, like people coming, like the people saying yes seem to be members of the team. We've got Ned voted yes.
I'm not being funny, Joe. Well, you've stacked this question up. You've sowed the seeds in their head before they even answered the question, and then you're surprised that results give you confirmation bias.
Yeah, well, I'm just
not
saying,
scientific. This I'm not scientific.
I'm just sitting back, liking this.
You said they're for kids, Joe. And Bunyip Studios says my missus eats refreshers, and she's nearly 60.
Right. Look, I'm starting to realise my error in letting you pick the comments. I will say that I'm sorry to to, who is it? Bunyip Studios.
Yeah.
Sorry to their missus. I don't mean to call them a child, but you've picked the comments and my research says otherwise.
Well, I'm a fair person, Joe. If there were any comments that were saying that refreshers were not...
There actually wasn't any. There weren't
any comments at all saying that.
I've not cherry-picked. I've just picked all of the refreshers-related comments.
Yeah.
And they've all been positive in support for the refreshers.
So, I love the way that all of that spurred from me just saying a quick analogy.
One of your James-isms.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know...
Be on a T-shirt next
If you
week.
Like strong Ribena, let us know in the comments.
Suppose Ribena's S-tier as well, is it?
No, I hate Ribena.
Oh, there we go. We're not going to argue about that, so it's fine.
No. This is an interesting one. Nyeb Stilgar says, you actually asked me to include this one, is the bearded host a part of Contradiction Cast, or am I crazy?
Right. I have some questions on this.
Questions for your questions.
So I'm going to answer your question with a question. What is that? I don't know. I'm not that. If that's a real person, then...
That's one of James's burner accounts.
That's not me.
No, not the
comment being a real person. The person they're asking if I am.
Right.
If that's a real thing. But I didn't know if this was like, if that's a real thing, like Contradiction Cast. Don't know what that is.
I looked it up. I could not find it.
If it is. Or if that's like a funny way of saying that I was contradicting myself. Because I was. I brought it up in the episode. I think where I was saying like, my thing was about painting the same model 10 times or whatever. Mm. But then previously I've said about getting away from Space Marines and stuff. And I did try and address that in the podcast. I think both of those points could be valid. And I thought maybe that this was a funny way of saying that I was contradicting myself. I like being referred to as the bearded host.
I like that we've got to the point with the podcast where like third party viewers have no idea who we are.
Yeah. I thought.
I also like the bearded host when James has also got the beard going on.
I've got a more noticeable beard, I would say. Okay. Yeah.
No, I've been
just darker.
I've been cutting the lawn a bit more recently. So yeah.
And actually, yeah, to be fair, I'm pretty sure I'm going to have to, I don't know if it's definitely that episode, but before we recorded.
I shaved, I think.
You were shaving in your office.
In his office, he was shaving his beard.
So
in the office, because you'd not have done that in the morning. That was like a normal person.
I was really busy.
Toothbrush hanging out of his mouth.
Yeah. Hey, look, when I get delayed by 10 minutes walking the dogs, it shunts the whole day back.
Yeah. You know? So I'd be interested to know, here's my follow-up questions. If someone else or that person could comment, let me know. Is that a real person you're comparing me to? Because it's not me. Or is that... is that just a funny way of saying I was contradicting myself?
Or both.
Or is it, really layered?
To be continued. Stay tuned.
If I happen to look like someone who's on something called Contradiction Cast, and also that they're calling me out for contradicting myself, that's a very layered comment, and I'll fair play.
Would you say it's an S-tier comment?
That's an S-tier comment. As a grown adult, not a child. A kid wouldn't understand it.
Just a quick one. We wanted to remind you that you can get your own miniatures painted by the world-class team here at Siege Studios. We offer a variety of painting levels and services to accommodate for a variety of needs and budgets. Whether you want a centerpiece character for your army or a full-blown gaming force, we have what you need, and we offer well above the industry standard in terms of painting quality and our service. You can learn more about our services and get a quote now at siegestudios.co.uk. And in the month of September, new clients can get 5% off of any commission using code SEPTEMBER5. Right. This is a topic for this week. We want to talk about the 5 common mistakes that beginners make.
Yep.
James, as a seasoned tutor running the Siege courses all over the country, I'm sure you've seen a lot of people from all experience painting.
Yeah.
This is not to call us the experts, obviously, but with a bit of experience under our belts. These are also the things that we personally have overcome.
Yeah, I've taught a lot of classes over the last 8 years, and you do see a lot of things. Like you do see a lot of things that you try and help people with, especially when they're new to painting miniatures. Number one, I think posture and hand bracing. I find a lot of people either sit very awkwardly, don't sit close enough to the desk, don't sit with their elbows or forearms on the desk. Hunch over a lot, and there's a big the biggest contributor to hunching over at a desk is lighting, and that reason for that is we obviously massively advocate a daylight that's above you on an arm so that you can sit comfortably underneath it, raise the height so you're straight backed, and then and obviously can just sit comfortably with forearms and elbows and hands braced on the desk.
It's interesting you say that, because I would have guessed that that would have been like due to table height or chair height.
Sometimes it can be table height, but what tends to happen is people will buy a smaller table light that's like just got a base and then it's just got like a little light.
That's what I had.
And what you'll do is you'll lean and crouch down to see under the light, if that makes sense.
Hmm.
Even if you have one of those small lights, like I've done it on classes before where someone's brought like a big carry box or whatever for their gear and their paints and all that. I've literally picked up the carry box, put the carry box on the desk, and then just pick the light up from the desk and put it on top of the carry box. And immediately they're like, oh, okay, I can just go under it now. Like, it sounds silly, but a big contributor to hunching over is lighting, because you have one of those smaller lights and you do lean forward to try and get under it, if that makes sense. And it's something psychologically you just don't realize. You just do it because you're trying to light the model and see what you're doing.
But so an easy way to solve that then is literally, it's not even get a new light, it's just put your light
not necessarily. If you don't need to go and buy one big arm lights.
What I eventually did, obviously we blew your mind with using the lid of the Tupperware for the thing.
That's a throwback.
But when you use the lid of the Tupperware, you have the actual Tupperware spare.
Uh-huh.
Put your light on that. Depending how big the Tupperware is.
Joking about TK Maxx now, are you, mate?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Put a light on that. That's what I used to do.
Big ups, everyone who's been listening since the TK Maxx days.
I've been there since TK Maxx, yeah.
We actually had quite a few people in the comments say, like, oh, I hope one there could say, I was here since the refresher days or something like that.
But yeah, like posture is really important, obviously, for obvious reasons. If you're going to be painting for, you know, many, many years in you know, painting miniatures in the hobby and you know, doing it, then you are going to have posture problems and you're going to have back problems.
I love the idea of like Joe sat there putting his Tupperware and his lamp on top and he's like, in 6 years, this is going to pay dividends.
Yeah, yeah. The thing is like, it will seriously give you problems down the line if you don't do it right from day one. You know, and you might have a year or two where you're doing that and it doesn't affect you, but you will start getting lower back pain and stuff like that. And again, I don't advocate anybody straining or being really sort of like firm with a hand or holding things really tight when they're painting, and that tends to be because of not bracing. And like, you should be able to comfortably hold the brush and do pull strokes, do push strokes with comfort rather than strain. Posture leads to that, and also bracing leads to that massively as well. So yeah, you should be, you know, chest or stomach to the desk, forearms on the table or elbows on the table, and also brace with your hands together. So like the thing I love about using the shot glasses, for example, is that because they are conical, what it means is you can put your fingers around the top, and this whole part of your hand becomes the area that you can bridge onto.
For any new listeners, he's saying use a shot glass to hold the model.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not apologies. To get drunk before you paint the model.
Yeah, sorry, apologies. I should have caveated that. But yeah, with being able
that
to...
That was something... I can't remember what the episode number was, but we went over that on a previous episode.
James did shot glasses. We can link it or whatever. I did Jenga pieces and... Yeah, we spoke about that. But yeah, but having multiple areas of bridging is really important. So being able to bridge your hands together or either bridge directly onto the bit that's around the holder that you're using is really important. I would always advocate an overhead light, because that will immediately make you sit up straighter and closer to the desk, because you can manipulate the arm, etc. So that's
you know what I started doing? I started dropping my chair.
That
to effectively
well, yeah.
make the table slightly taller.
Yeah.
Therefore, I can rest
Put
my wrists and my elbows
under the
far.
Light more.
Exactly.
Well.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really helpful. I mean, if you do have like a gaming chair or whatever, like a secret lab chair, or if you have like a whatever, blah, blah, like being able to adjust it and also still be comfortable and straight back.
You don't need a gaming chair to have high adjust.
No, I mean, yeah, you can.
No, I know you can get different chairs.
You can
chairs,
get that function
but,
on other chairs. Yeah, but no, gaming chair looks cooler.
It looks cooler and it's more comfortable.
It is more comfortable. To be fair, I used to use just any old chair and like any old office chair or whatever until we got the secret lab chairs in the office. And I was like, oh, okay, that's actually incredibly comfortable.
I actually did that a couple before I started at Siege. I got one of the secret lab chairs. And then when I started here, I was like, oh, my God.
they are like, the thing is, whether even in the sitting at a desk and writing emails all day or whether you're painting, that posture and comfort are really, really important. And you know, it just allows you to do that thing for longer without potentially causing long-term damage or long-term strains or frustration for future when we want to.
If you're good, if it's one of those things, right, where like if you're going to be sat in it for like many, many hours and it's going to last you many, many years. I mean, I've gone through, I'm not saying necessarily to buy a Secret Labs chair, obviously there's plenty of other companies, but I used to get through like, I don't know about you, like an office chair a year. Like just from the amount like of like 100 or... quid chairs I've bought that I've eventually worn through and I'm just sat on bare metal or plywood.
Yeah.
Finally making that, I'd say that was probably actually one of the biggest, I wish I thought this before in a previous episode, but probably one of the best investments I've made in my hobby setup was spending some good money and getting a nice chair.
Yeah. I mean, the thing, the other thing to talk about and the other thing to bolt onto this as well is that like, I totally understand, and this is from conversations I have with hundreds of students on classes like over the years, like not everybody has a proper painting room or has a desk set up or has whatever. Like a lot of people do paint at the coffee table or do paint at their dining table or whatever.
In there. Yeah.
I totally understand that there are different situations and circumstances out there for people. But all I would say is that whether you're painting at a coffee table or whether you're painting at a dining table, just trying to make sure that in some shape or form you are sitting comfortably, straight backed, arms braced on the flat surface. And whether that's, if it's a coffee table, sitting on the floor cross-legged and so that you're at a similar sort of height so you can brace, which would probably help you if you've got one of those shorter lights as well, because it would lower you and the light would become higher. If you're at a dining table, buying a chair that you can store somewhere that when you put it up the table, it is more comfortable and allows you to sit in that position. That's a better trade-off than just putting yourself in a situation where you are hurting your back.
Yeah, I think there's like... there's a middle ground to be had where like, we're not saying you need all this really expensive stuff in a fancy station to improve your experience.
Definitely. Yeah.
I always get a bit like, it's when we're recommending stuff, especially like we're just talking about like casually talking about a £400 chair.
Yeah.
More like, than that in some cases.
Yeah. Or like more than that. Like, I always get a bit conscious of it because obviously not everyone can afford a £400 chair. There's plenty of, other options. But then I remember like we are also talking to people that spend like hundreds of pounds on models.
That's interesting.
So I find like, if you are spending
this is not to call anyone out, obviously, but I do find interesting that people, I get it to a degree, but I do find interesting that people will spend loads of money on a new range of paints or a load of new models that are probably just going to sit and be on the sprues for years and years in a box. It's not so much about spending money on those things, it's maybe just considering what you're currently spending on. Maybe
I'll be honest,
within your hobby budget, right? I'm saying maybe instead of buying some new models or instead of buying that new paint range, you put it towards an investment like a better lamp or a desk that's a bit higher up. Or
I only bought any of that stuff, new lamp, new chair, good brushes. I only bought any of that once my like pile of shame got so much where I was like, I literally should not be buying any more models. Like if I'm going to, so I was just buying models ahead of all that. I do get it. Like that's the thing that we're all interested in. That's what, it's way more appealing to spend £100 on models than save that £100, put it towards a really nice chair or something. It's way more appealing.
Depends how into chairs you are.
Yeah. It depends how into chairs. Well, it depends if it's got the function to change the height.
Revolutionary
so I
technology.
Do get it. Yeah. So it's a bit of a fine line. I always get a bit thingy. But what I was going to say is to James's point of not needing the best setup and things like that, not going to like out them or say the full story or anything, but we've had people join the team that when you hear different people's painting situations and then you see how good they are at painting,
yeah,
it will make you realize, oh, what am I doing?
Like,
lazy perfectionist thing again. Yeah, like I get that with, I've got to make sure the setup's perfect. Otherwise, I'm not going to be able to paint the perfect model.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we'll get people join the team and they'll explain what their setup is. And it's like what I would have, you know, what anyone could have a setup of.
Yeah, yeah.
Some cases, not even using a table because of like room in the room that's available and stuff. And then painting some of the most incredible models I've ever seen. And it's like...
there is clearly zero correlation between your setup and how good of a
painter you are. Yeah, it's not that. Yeah. It's like I was just going through things of, oh, it must be this why I don't paint that good. Oh, it must be this.
The only thing I would say, and just not to counter, but just to say that, is if you have someone who's maybe not in the most comfortable situation for painting and they're painting amazingly, how much better would they paint if they were?
I do agree with
it's
that.
It's not going to hurt. Were,
yeah, I do agree with that.
That's why. That's the point I'm trying
it's
to make.
It's a quality like, of life like, thing. You're spending hours yeah. doing something, so you know. But you know, put that benefit yourself.
Yeah.
By if you're going to be there for hours,
exactly.
Make yourself as comfortable as possible. And we've gone through before as well, like clean space gives you a better mindset and things like that. I don't disagree with all that. I'm just saying you can find some level of what we're saying here within your budget and space and whatever. I don't have big space at all to do painting. I don't have a painting desk. I have like a multi-use desk.
Yeah.
Where like I have to, okay, now my painting stuff's on it. Okay, now my painting stuff's off it. Like yeah. I don't have set up with all the
racks and everything.
Racks and everything. Yeah. They're off to the side in a separate thing. Then I just go and get the ones that I need and stuff like that. So everyone's got different priorities in that stuff, I suppose. But
the fundamental thing is on that note and on that topic is literally just assess where you work and just go, right, okay, is this number one the best function I've got from it? And also secondly, and most in my opinion, most importantly, is it comfortable? Am I straining? Am I bracing? Am I bending over, like leaning over? You know, those kind of things are things that you really should assess your workspace because it directly affects all the things that you try and do at that painting desk. Yeah, I think it's a really important part. I think it's something that one of the things that I've instantly seen the most of when teaching are people that are constrained by a light that's very low. They lean over. And there you can see them not being able to brace, or they sit really far back from the table. And it's like, if you were closer, you'd be able to be way more braced and way more comfortable. And that shaky hand potentially that you're experiencing won't happen as much because you can relax a bit more, you know. And that's one of the things.
Let's move on from that then. So what's one of the next things that you see people making as a mistake?
Building the models really quickly without thinking of like choices for parts and the painting approach. You get super excited that you're like, oh, I've bought this new kit, you know, and you first get into it and you're like, oh, I'm just going to put the models together, blah, blah. And I'm not talking about sub-assemblies. I know that's going to trigger you, Joe, but like,
I'm actually painting in a sub-assembly currently.
You're painting in a sub-assembly?
You're okay.
So,
do you need to talk?
we'll talk about it probably in, not next episode, probably the episode after or something when the model's done, but there was a reason behind it. I thought it would be funny for me to, like, I tried to do everyone's, so I thought like, oh, I'll paint in sub-assemblies and I'm using like shot glasses instead of like what Jenga. I would normally use and stuff like that. But genuinely, I went from full sub-assemblies to within like
seconds,
like a few minutes.
In
a few
he set minutes, up the palette, and he's like, "No, I can't." Do
within
it.
A few minutes, I just
he
like
puts
looked
the part
at it.
On the shot glass. Can't do it.
I just looked at it, and I was like, "No." So I've reduced the amount of sub assemblies, but I'm still doing sub assemblies. Yeah. But yeah, so I'm not triggered.
Have you ever done this, James? Have you ever had a sub assembly where bits of it still come off? It's like I've got a sub assembly arm, but don't worry, I can still take the shoulder pad off. It's blue tacked.
I have one of those at the moment. Yeah. No. What I mean is like. It is where you get a new kit and you've been, especially with the way things are now, you see it go up on community or you see it go up on a company's website, you get super excited, the pre-order date goes up, you pre-order it, you go down to, you pick it up or it arrives or whatever, you get the box, you know, when you combine that with being new into this as well, so you've got that excitement of it being this whole new thing that you're getting into, and you've got the excitement of this thing that you've loved from the moment you've seen it, and it's been obviously, there's been a wait, you know, of to get it, and then you get it, and beginners will just put the models together really quickly and then the painting thought begins at that point once it's built, whereas taking a second to go, all right, okay, well, I really like that shoulder pad, or I really like that, or I really like this, or I really like that.
Oh, do you mean in terms of if it's like a multi-part kit, choosing if it's not necessarily a war gear option, if it's like decorative, right?
Yeah,
like a box
yeah.
of Innocence has loads of different shoulder pads or yeah. different head options or helmets.
It's things like a lot of models don't come with like purity seals attached, for example, or they come with like a different topper for the backpack or something like that. All those kind of things. Like it's just building the model really quickly, getting it built because you want to get it built because you want to get onto the painting, but not taking a second to go, right, okay, before I get through that, I'm just going to pick the bits or have a look at the parts and think, oh, I like this, I like this, or maybe I don't, that might be a bit more difficult to paint, or maybe I don't think my skills at the point where I can paint that yet, or I'm not sure on how to paint that. Like taking a brief second to go, right, okay, and looking at the kit and looking at the parts before rushing through the build of it and getting it built, I think that helps massively. I think sometimes new painters do just build the model really quickly and to get onto the painting because they're super excited to paint. But then once they've built it, they're like, oh, I've stuck that on now. But do you know what? I really like that head or that topper or that shoulder pad or whatever, you know what I mean? And I think having that brief moment of like absorbing what's actually presented to you in the kit, but with a painting mindset and thinking, oh, do I want to paint that or do I want to do that? I think that helps. I know a lot of people will kind of do that during the build, but when you're new and you're getting into this, I think the excitement of getting it built and getting onto that fun painting stage is sometimes blurs the thoughts when it comes to actually how you're going to paint it.
Sometimes what's coolest looking as well isn't necessarily best suited for the paint scheme or composition if you're doing like a big piece or something like that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Sometimes like law based reasons that they might, it's probably better for them to have this than this or.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I think just that slight pause to just reflect on what's in the kit and think of it with the painting mindset will really help, because it just means you can make choices that are more tailored to perhaps where you're at as a painter, or make choices which are going to test you or vice versa, you know? So that's kind of like something that I've noticed.
I also think it like helps, having that mindset helps get you into kind of embracing like the therapeutic nature that building and cleaning can be.
It can, yeah. Like hate building, but yeah.
I used to hate building and cleaning. Like I used to, you know, when I was starting, do what you were just saying. And like, I'll tell you now, I never once put an extra purity seal on a model. Not once, not once in my life did I ever, if I was painting some marines, put an extra purity seal on, because there's more to paint.
Are you one of those people who's like building a box of TAC marines and you're like, they don't need belts. They don't need holsters.
Yeah. They don't need that.
Yeah.
They lost the pistol in battle.
narrative. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely used to be like that. And it's so funny, like looking back, when I've got back into Warhammer, was mostly with Barrett, who you've met.
Yeah.
I don't think you've met Barrett, but and we were so polar opposite in terms of when it came to building, mm-hmm. in that I would still want to, well, maybe not polar opposite, but like I would want to get through it quickly, but I would follow the instructions and make sure that I was getting everything right. He would literally like just chuck the instructions away, just have a look at what parts he's got and go, right, bang, 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 bang. That goes together like that. That looks like it goes together there. Yeah, that looks fine. Whatever, done. And that I could never have done that. So I wasn't at that level.
No,
of it.
No. Okay, yeah.
But
I love building models because I do this like make-believe thing, right? You know when you see those like videos of like someone like building a watch,
yeah,
and they've got like the velvet gloves on, yeah, and they're like doing everything all precise. I like to feel like that. It's my like escapism.
I thought you were going to say that you do like, you know, the animation they released of the making a space
movie, yeah, yeah,
where like the armor's coming on and stuff. I thought you were going to say that you have your little model there and you like have the shoulder pads coming up. You're making all the sounds. You're like, shh, and you're doing
it's
the
like
voiceover.
Darth Vader's helmet. It's just like,
yeah. You're like doing the voiceover to yourself, like every single Marine.
I mean, that would take ages to make them.
Someone must have done like a fan-made version of that with like an
if not,
model.
It's going to happen. So
someone's got to do that.
Yeah, I forget the point. The building and cleaning thing. Like I always used to be like that. And weirdly, even just recently, like I did obviously starting working here, realize the importance of building and cleaning.
Yeah, yeah.
I always just used to like look past mold lines and stuff like that. I don't care. Like, whatever. I wish I did acknowledge that stuff sooner. So I think it would have improved my painting quicker, because it's impossible to get better at painting when the model's not clean properly.
We spoke about that on a previous episode, didn't we? It's like shooting yourself in the foot before you start the race, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
No good paint job can overcome.
But it wasn't
a mold line.
It wasn't until literally this year, like even so, acknowledging that it was more important and paying more attention to it and stuff, it wasn't until this year I was talking to Liam Dempsey. I think, I don't know when. Maybe at Fest, or it might have even been before that when we were in like Gibraltar or something. But I remember him saying like, oh, I love building and cleaning.
Yeah.
Like I love just building and cleaning the models. Because we was obviously talking about painting models for him, and he was like, yeah, I love building and cleaning. And I was like, oh yeah, I suppose it can be enjoyable actually. can be quite nice.
I have a friend who doesn't paint and doesn't play the games. He literally just buys the boxes, models, puts them together, and then that's it.
I guess that is like the Gundam stuff. Yeah, it's mostly just just building the models, right?
That's the fun thing.
For me, it is. Obviously, for me, the painting is very important, but I think the building and cleaning is on par. I think because I think a lot of people hate it because they want to get onto the painting, arguably for the right reasons, because they want to get the models painted. But if you overlook that, then I think it's a bit of a shame because there are things that massively detract from a well-painted model if they're not done correctly or not done neatly, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But to touch upon it, like the whole thing I was saying is like, not so much obviously the quality, if you want to use an analogy, not so much like a painter choosing a worn canvas or a pristine canvas, it's more choosing the right size canvas for what they're actually going to render and paint. And that's the way I'm trying to basically explain it. It's like,
you're talking more about deciding the options. Deciding the options,
the quality, build and clean it really well, like either way, irrespective of like whether you're just going, oh, I'm going to build it and get it built, ready to paint, or take a moment to go, right, okay, well, I'm building the captain, comes with a power fist, comes with a sword. Maybe I'm not so good at metallics or I'm not so good at blendings for the sword, but the power fist, I know I can edge highlight that really sharply. So then like making choices.
Or equally, you could be like, oh, I was going to do a power fist for this, but actually if I do a sword, I can paint it in a different color that contrasts the armor nicely.
Yeah.
And that'll make a nicer
color
scheme for the model. Right?
Correct. Yeah. And that's what I'm talking about. It's that little pause to literally just go, right, I know I'm going to build this and I'm going to enjoy building it and have fun building it and do it really well. But rather than just getting it done without any of the aforethought for the painting, it's literally just going, right, I'm going to make some choices or have some thought about the parts I'm going to choose and bits and bobs so that I can enjoy the painting aspect even more, if that makes sense. So yeah,
have you got one final thing that you've noticed beginners doing?
Yeah, I think from a lot of the airbrush classes and the airbrush sections on courses that I've taught over the years, I think that the airbrush is this kind of like pedestal wonder product that a lot of people that a lot of people think that you kind of like you get it and it makes you amazing straight away, and arguably like it is a very, very, very important tool. Very important tool when it comes to miniature painting because it does save you time and improve quality of base coats. You know, we've spoken about you would never paint a tank with a brush again after using an airbrush, etc. But it's similar to sort of like when you buy models and you want to get them built and you want to get them done straight away. I think a lot of people will buy an airbrush the first time they get one, they get into it, they see obviously a YouTube video, their friend's got an airbrush or whatever the case may be, and how they find out about the airbrush in general. And they'll just buy one and pick a model up straight away. And I think that's a huge, huge mistake because it massively makes you think that the tool is not as good as it's supposed to be, or that makes you feel that you're not good enough, if that makes sense. I've literally had classes where someone's come on the class and they've never picked up an airbrush in their life, and they've sat there with an airbrush with a bit of cardboard or paper with some water with a bit of ink in it, and they've practiced dots, lines, transitions, smooth passes, all that kind of stuff for 30 minutes. And then you give them the model and then they get some paint and try and put it on. The difference between the person who's had that half an hour of practice and the person who's super excited to use it and picks it up and goes, shh, and makes a big splodge on the model straight away or layers too thick.
Especially if, God forbid, it's like an expensive model or one you're proud of, or one you've spent ages painting.
Yeah, 100%. I think that's a big thing that like people who are getting into this and who are getting new into the industry and new into painting miniatures, I think like if you are going to go down the route of buying an airbrush, perfect. I would advise it to everybody. Like, you know, it is a tool that you should have, you should use if you're looking to be efficient, save time, maximize quality, all those things. But don't just maybe use it straight away on a miniature. Practice on some cardboard, practice on some paper, practice on something. You could, I suppose, practice on a model that you don't really care about. But I think practicing those core competencies of trigger control, distance from object, and obviously
I think probably both of those things, to be honest. I would say practice on 2D paper, card, what have you, and then graduate to a test model or a model you're not happy with
potentially,
and then go on to, because obviously doing it on a 3D volumetric shape is different than doing it on the paper, right?
Yeah
but I would say that doing it on a test model even before you go onto your
maybe that's a good process then, is do it on paper and card first on a 2D so you can just control the trigger, learn the biting point of the trigger where paint and air comes out at the same time if using a dual action and all those different bits, and then maybe progress onto a volumetric shape. Maybe.
Because you're not going to pick up on the directionality of like where you're spraying from and things like that and the volumes. Because obviously, if you've got something blocking another part of the model when you're spraying with an airbrush, the airbrush only goes, it only fires paint in a straight line, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you're not picking up that technique from testing lines on paper.
No, correct. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that, maybe that's the thing to do. Maybe it is to do the paper or do card or whatever. And then maybe get something that maybe a miniature, but or maybe even just a volume. So like a sphere, a cube.
I'd say a model. I mean, everyone's, I'm sure, has got some test models or some models.
Yeah, potentially.
You can get some ones.
I'm talking if you're new and you've literally bought an airbrush and you've got maybe like, you've not got like the Aladdin's Cave of Grey Shame, you know?
No, but like even GW do like the free, like in the
sense. I'm saying if you're completely new, then I would say just do it on your first models, because as I've said before, your first models are going to be rubbish anyway. So treat your first models as your test.
I think most people get an airbrush later into the hobby as well.
I don't know. I mean, on some classes, I've had painters that have, I've had students that have been literally, they've been in the industry, in the hobby for like a month, and they've bought an airbrush straight away.
They must
have watched a video, or they must have known somebody that has one, and they've just got, and that's in that's painting miniatures, and has gone, well, you definitely need an airbrush, or you definitely need this. Nothing wrong with getting one when you're very new. I think just applying that hour, half hour of practice before you even go near a model is something that you should do.
I would say in terms of practice models, actually, even if you are new, just get some like ones that are already painted really badly, going for cheap on eBay or something.
Yeah, that can work, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I have a Rhino that's one of the first models I ever bought. And I, God knows how many coats of paint that's had on
that is literally
my like just test. I just test the consistency on it before I like
go onto the model.
Rhinos are like a dime a dozen. I think it's on Poor Hammer podcast. They said like rhinos are free. People don't know this, but everyone has got rhinos.
Yeah, like it's one of the first models I ever got, and it's just been caked in paint just from initially.
That kit's so old, they're just everywhere.
Yeah, initially practicing it, but. Now it's like I just test out different paints on it and stuff. So yeah, getting some old models and just, you don't want them to look good at the end of the day. Well, so it's gonna, doesn't matter. Just keep going over.
I mean, GW have the intro magazine thing. You can get, they're really cheap, and they also have, I'm pretty sure you can get free model in store if you go in.
I think they do that now.
It's a different model every month. I do think, however, depending on how chill your local store manager is, I think you do have to build them in store. Walk away with them.
That's fine.
It's fine. Yeah.
But just, I mean, you can't just pop in and go, can I have one of them? Yep, cool.
No, I get that. I'm just saying in terms of accessibility for a test model.
Yeah. I think you have to build them in store. It's obviously to get people in the stores and stuff. It's a really cool idea, actually.
Yeah, that's the only thing. That's the only thing that I've seen a few people do is they buy an airbrush very early on, and they don't do that. They grab a model and start painting with and start using it. And then one of the first things they'll say when they come to class in the airbrush section is, yeah, I bought it. I tried a model and I didn't pick it up because I made such a mistake on it. And it's like, it's kind of like the expectation compared to the execution is very far because of not doing that practice.
Well, this is the YouTube doesn't tell you the full story thing, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I think yours was a bit similar, wasn't it? Your painting mistake on the airbrush front or spraying models
kind of
front.
Yeah, it wasn't quite the airbrush front. It was before the airbrush days. But I think I just didn't... I didn't really take into consideration about like spraying too much primer on. Like, and it's not until you see like, I think I just used to just cake models in it because I would have missed like a little spot. And then you're trying to get that little spot and you end up just like flooding the model in more spray.
You mean
primer.
Like when you've got like a little bit under the armpit that's like still showing through.
Exactly.
So you go, I'm going to spray the whole front of the model again.
Yeah, I do think since having... I've touched on it before where I'll prime with Color Forge black, and then if the model's going to be black, obviously I'll spray with black after still, or I'll airbrush the main color for whatever the model is. And I just think being okay with some of the primer not covering like little details, as long as the base coat does cover it, that's not done me any wrong now. And I wish I kind of was a bit less liberal with the primer than I was originally.
I think within reason, like providing it's not like a massive area.
I'm talking, it's hard to describe, right?
I do know what you mean, though.
It's like,
it's almost like a color gradient rather than like a...
It's more noticeable because I've been painting with the Warhammer Heroes, they're blue plastic, and obviously I sprayed black over it. So that's more noticeable. You can see it coming through.
Yeah.
What I'm getting at is, obviously, by the end of you doing your first base coat, you don't want any of the plastic showing through. Yeah. I'm not saying leave plastic showing through.
I'm saying
what you can't get with the primer. Sometimes it's worth, if you've missed a little bit with a primer, I wish I was more okay with just leaving that, because I'll get it with a base coat and nothing's... You've seen a little armpit or something, nothing's going to actually be touching that to take
You're saying leaving a bit of bare plastic is worse than the alternative of spraying primer over it again and gunking up all the details.
I think that leads on to an issue that does happen with new people that do get into this. They buy the spray can, and spray cans are obviously used in all manner of different ways, as in like for different things. And I think with miniatures, the delicacy of how you apply it is way higher than, say, for example, if you were spraying a bit of metal outside or spraying something like you, the use of the can is what I'm talking about. So a lot of people that I've seen using cans, like that are very new into the hobby, will hold down the percussion cap on the top and they'll hold that down constantly while spraying. And that is completely uncontrolled, and you're doing passes with the can and putting on lots of layers of individual passes. Whereas really one of the first things I'll say to people in classes about primer with a can is that you should use the percussion cap, or you should use the trigger on the spray can exactly the same as how you would use the trigger on an airbrush and burst fire whilst moving. It's because what that does is it gives you a control of application. So you're doing the individual passes, the push down and movement at the same time. And also you can split your attention between angling the model whilst you're doing the individual bursts to cover all those areas. And hopefully by doing that, you will then get every area of it and give it a solid base coat, undercoat, if that makes sense. But I think one of the big mistakes is that, and this is what happens because like spray cans have obviously pigment, they have propellant and they have medium in them. So they've got way more than just putting a paint into an airbrush and diluting it, if that makes sense. So the layers that you're going to put on, and because it is designed to be an undercoat, the Chaos Black or the Color Forge Black or whatever primer that you use, if you do hold it down and just go like this, you're going to gunk up details with very thick paint very quickly. And I think that's one of the mistakes that a lot of new painters do, or new hobbyists do is they buy a spray can and they'll just hold that trigger down and go like this, and it just you're completely uncontrolled in the execution, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I was never doing that. I feel like I know people do that, but I think instinctively, for whatever reason, it just felt right to do like bursts.
Yeah,
I think, and George will like this, I think it does say it on the instructions of most spray cans.
Do you love reading,
especially when they're tailored to miniature painting. I think it tells you to do bursts.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think for me, it would just be like, obviously now more experienced, more controlled, like you say, I am able to fully cover the model.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In a controlled fashion with a thin primer.
Yeah, yeah.
But back then, I used to just like see a tiny little bit and think, oh, I've got to get rid of it. And then just end up putting loads more coats of primer on to get rid of this tiny little bit that I could have just covered with a base coat,
yeah,
and it wouldn't have rubbed off because it's inside, it's in an armpit or whatever.
And in turn, you wouldn't have gone up.
In turn, I wouldn't have had this really thick primer.
Yeah,
I think that was a mistake that I think it stands out as a mistake for me. It's because it was something that I just never even addressed as a mistake. I just used to be like, oh, this primer's thick, isn't it?
Just
like, well, no, yeah, because I'm putting it on like that.
So on that note as well, I've also got something that is going to tie in directly to this week's hobby hack at the end of the episode, so stick around for that. But the can's distance from the object as well is actually really crucial, because there is, and again, touching on your point on labels, I think it does say on most cans the optimal distance that you should hold the can.
So it can read a spray can instructions, but he can't read.
Only when he wants to. So I'm going to assume this is because he wants to disprove that. Are you going to label?
No, I'm not going against it. Okay, actually.
Right. Reads them when he wants to go against them.
But I've got a valid point as to why. There's loads of warning symbols on the cans, George. There's none on the Vallejo ones.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
we won't get into the international law of the European Union.
There's no big red skull and crossbone symbols on the thinner and cleaner. But anyway, So distance from the object or distance from target when using the can is also really crucial
distance
because
from target.
Well, it is.
He's locking in.
Steady.
Distance from target.
Yeah. Steady. Steady.
So the distance that you hold the can from the objects as well is really crucial, purely because obviously as the paint atomizes when it leaves the nozzle of the can, it's drying in that distance from the can to the object, obviously because it's been atomized. So if you are further away from the object, there's more distance for that paint and medium to travel, which means it's going to be drying more over that distance. When it hits the object, if it's further away, you will get a more powdery finish as well.
Not to overcomplicate it as well, but the distance thing is weather dependent and temperature dependent.
So I was about
to
say this. I always thought that was way too granular way to think about it. It's not going to make that much of a difference.
It does.
But the distance mixed with the weather genuinely makes so much of a difference.
The same, in the same way that with the airbrush, your paint thinness and consistency versus the distance from the model has the same effect. Yeah. So if that's something you're familiar with, apply that to your spray cans.
Do you know what? Like, even though they're very different, they're used for very different purposes, as in like undercoating, maybe priming if you're using a colour can, like your Mephiston Reds or McCraig Blues or whatever, blah, blah.
Go straight to Mephiston Red, Joe. Obviously.
Yeah. Don't trigger me, please. The way that the can works and the functionality is actually very similar to an airbrush in a lot of extents. Obviously, you know, the paint being put through it is very different in the way that the makeup and stuff. But yeah, I think distance from the object or target is really, really crucial. So do read the can and do follow the optimal distance.
I'm not going to be able to help myself next time I come to spray a model now. I'm just going to be like,
stay on target.
Can we have target fire? Can someone edit the trench run from A New Hope? And as he's locking on to the to the Death Star, it's just a space marine.
That's it.
Space marine with a spray gun.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So I think that's really important. But the hobby hack that we're going to give this week will help in case that is
a little tease for the hobby hack.
It is a little tease for it.
I'll round out the topic then with my mistake that I made, which was I was so obsessed with blending as smooth as possible.
Yep.
That I would kill all of the contrast on my models because the more you try to blend something naturally, the smaller the change in value is going to be. Mm-hmm. And all my models for the longest time, it's like, yeah, they're smooth, but they have no contrast on them whatsoever. And that's why I struggle with NMM in the couple of times that I've tried it. My brain can't comprehend.
Truth comes out. That's why 10
episodes
like
later. Yeah.
I can't bring myself to leave with the NMM thing. I can't bring myself to leave a harsh line on something. My brain is like, well, I have to blend it out. And then you blend it out and then it's basically gone. It's you never done smooth, it.
But then the thing is, I think the way to immediately stamp that out is have a look at real life reference of gold, silvers, like candelabras or door handles.
Oh, it's obviously apparent. It's just that thing in my brain of on the blending thing. I mean, I don't really struggle with it now so much. That being okay with bigger value jumps obviously brings out more and more details in the model, which is why the box art style was very edge highlighted, very heavy on that front.
Yeah.
That was something that I'm not sure how applicable that necessarily is to other people. That's definitely something that I was struggling with. I know a lot of people say the model needs more contrast and that can be for a myriad of reasons. But for me, it was the smoothness thing that ticked
my
mind.
I'm the same. I just hate when my blends are so smooth. And I'm just I'll finish the model and I'll be like, this is the smoothest blends I've ever seen.
It's so smooth. It looks like one color.
I'll spray the model that we were just talking about. I'll, target acquired. And then I'll just be like, damn, these blends. I don't know what to. Yeah. No, I do get what you're saying. Interestingly, you say you don't know how applicable it is to other people. We've had multiple conversations with team over the years who are still here or not here. And I remember at one stage, one of the biggest tips that we were having to give to people were don't be scared that your final edge highlight is going to be a stark edge highlight. It is a common thing where it's you do get a bit wary of the color jump, the stark jump. But it's very much trust the process, isn't it? And then the end product is going to look better for it.
It's almost like muscle memory because you do get to a point where you start selecting colors when you're trying to do either transitions or maybe even for highlight stages on a model and things like that. It doesn't necessarily just have to translate just to blending. But like edge highlighting, when you're doing the chunky, the first thin, the next part of the thin, the next bit of the thin, then the dot highlight or whatever, like, bear in mind it's on a 28mm model, and to visually see all those stages, you do need to have a greater scope of color jump to allow that. And also, that's before we even talk about color desaturating a little bit once it dries, because it does desaturate a tiny bit, as obviously,
especially when you start mixing as well.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, so I think obviously you can go too crazy and the jump be like a blooming long jump, blooming jump, if that makes sense. But like, you
long
know,
long jump, jump, jump,
long jump, 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 blimmin' jump,
long, yeah, long jump, blimmin' jump. Jump, yeah.
Thanks, James.
But yeah, we won't clip that one. But I
feel for you there, because I would know what to call, what to say.
It's no Ribena.
It's no Ribena. But the what I'm trying to get at is, you can go too far. Like, yeah, you can, the jump that you make can be so extreme that it does look like the edges are literally on fire or glowing. You know,
the classic is highlighting black with white.
Yeah.
That being, yeah, it's on the same scale, but like, that's too far.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's too much. Like, so yeah, I would just say, like, you, that kind of color muscle memory, if you want to call it anything, I think that comes with just experimenting. And again, as a beginner, you're not going to have that. So you probably are going to be a bit more restricted in, oh, if I use this green, I'm only going to use this green to highlight it, whereas most likely you probably need to go three or four colors higher to make a sizable disparity in difference of color to visually see it, if that makes sense. So yeah.
Question of the week time. Thank you everyone for submitting your questions in the comment section for question of the week. If you have something that you'd like to ask us and have us answer on the show, please do leave a comment on the YouTube version of this podcast. Got a good one this week. Love this username. Pretzelmeister.
Solid name.
Says, I'm having trouble finding the motivation to paint. Do you have any advice? Oh, this is like a hotline, this, isn't it?
Yeah. I think please help.
I think it's situational, because obviously we, like, so I'm going to address him by the formal name. So Pretzelmeister, obviously we're going to take it as a generalist question, because there's no specific, like, I'm painting this and I'm struggling with this or whatever. But I think, in my opinion, I would paint something different to what you're painting. And I know we've touched upon it on other episodes before, but I do really think that when you paint something that's so different from the thing that you paint all the time, be it color, be it model, be it faction, be it game system, be it whatever, that's going to help you to kind of hit the reset button on motivation, because it just gives you something different to focus on.
I'm going
to
throw something into that, because people always think like, oh, I'm painting Space Marines, try painting a different faction. I'm going to rule that out. Try painting like a scale model car,
or a
bust,
yeah,
or a 75mm fantasy figure based on a movie. Like, go completely off base.
Yeah, it's having multiple things on your kind of whip shelf at once, isn't it? Like,
variety.
And I think going on the topic of the episode, almost, talking about the building and cleaning thing, if you start treating building and cleaning as an activity in itself, something to focus on, if you're not motivated to paint this evening, but you've got six boxes of models that need building, just kind of be okay with the fact that, like, I don't really fancy painting, but I'm going to build them. Mm-hmm. I'm going to put some effort into building them.
Yeah.
And as we've also touched on, nothing gets you pumped to paint like building new models, because you just want to rush and get paint on them.
Mm.
So having a little break from it, while still working on a different skill, or if you want to start maybe learning sculpting, so things like that, you can still benefit your hobby progress without having to paint. If you have to force the motivation, it's not always going to work out, I think. But also, I would recommend, I think episode one of this podcast, we spoke about inspirational painting moments and things.
Yeah,
things that really got us like raring to paint, and we go over a few things in there. And I think if you are near, I don't know where Mr. Meister lives, but if you're near somewhere that has, you know, a shop with a really nice selection of models on show, if you happen to be in the UK and you can get to Warhammer World, do the exhibition. Nothing will get you motivated to paint like going through that exhibition,
yeah,
at Warhammer World. Like, you know, God knows where this person lives. They might not be able to do that. But if it turns out they live in Nottingham, then they've probably been too much and it doesn't have the
desensitized to the to the exhibition.
But just seeing amazing models in person.
I agree, yeah.
Warhammer World is worth like a significant pilgrimage.
That is the right word to call it.
It is worth it. I went Warhammer World. It wasn't even on my radar, really. And then we went for a staff event, Siege. Nuts place.
Had you ever been before?
Never been before.
Yeah, okay.
But like that
had
was...
you ever, you'd probably, I guarantee, because I was the same, not before then, but before I went, were you ever actually that bothered about going, or were you like...
Oh, not that bothered. And I didn't think as well, I didn't realise that the like museum exhibition thing was like multiple rooms, like a couple of hours to get through. I was thinking it'd be like a little room with some like box art models in it.
Huge dioramas.
Yeah.
Massive stuff.
You've got to do
slash
it.
Jewels. Like, massive
if,
stuff.
If you're watching this...
Like stuff you have to climb stairs to look at. Like.
Yeah. And it's... Majority of it is it's the box art models.
Yeah.
It's the models that are on... The box.
The box art models in a cabinet.
Yeah.
In front of your face.
Yeah.
Like, and I think I spoke about it before. I don't know if I mentioned it on the podcast, but there was that old Tower Ethereal that I was painting.
Yeah.
And you can't find any pictures of it anywhere because it never actually had box art in terms of like, it didn't come in a box.
Was it the Army Box Special Edition?
It was the Army Box Special Edition one. It's a metal model.
Yeah.
And I could not for the life of me find a picture of the back of it. And I had no reference on how to paint the back of this model. And then I'd given up pretty much. On a separate point, went to Warhammer World. They've got the box art model. Because obviously they had an heavy metal version of the model to have in magazines and stuff, but you only had the front image. And it's on a display that has a mirror behind it.
Brilliant.
And I literally zoomed in on my phone on the mirror, got a picture of the back of the model. And unless anyone else has done that, I think I must have the only picture that exists of the back of that model. And it really helped. So like it's insane the models that you can see going there.
It's worth traveling. Like even if you're elsewhere in the UK and it's like multiple hours
Week, I'm going up to Sheffield on the Saturday. And I am planning an extra couple of hours just to stop off in Nottingham and just like go in there just because I haven't been in a little while, like just to get a bit of motivation.
It is really, really, really worth it. Like even if you're not in the UK and you're coming over to the UK, like England's not the biggest country in the world. You can pretty much get anywhere in England for within a day.
Not within a day, within like 6 hours.
Yeah.
So there's 24 hours in a day, George.
He's got you there. Technically, within a day.
So how much sleep do you want?
Yeah.
Like, you can pretty much get, if you're in the UK, you can get there within a day. And I would strongly advise, like, if you're into this and you've never been, like, to go. Because the funniest thing, obviously, for me is, I've seen Warhammer World change massively over the years from when I started. I went when I was very young, and I remember seeing like the Siege of the Emperor's Palace. That was a display. It was a fireplace they converted into the gate with like a titan, like titans. That's all obviously not there anymore now. But I've seen it gone from a really tiny little museum all the way through to this crazy thing that you experienced as the first time when we done that Siege Christmas do, and we're all up there. To see that progression of it, I was like you back then in the day when it was a fireplace and 300, 400 models, whatever it was. But to really how it is now is like the most incredible.
I think there's 400 models in the first cabinet.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Do you know what I'll say as well? First time I went was 2017, I think, and been, you know, sporadically since then. The exhibition, first of all, you can go in there. You can go in the shops. You can use the game hall. You can go to Bugman's Bar, all free. Mm-hmm. You just walk in. Don't need to book anything. And then the exhibition, which is the only thing really you have to pay for, mm-hmm. other than all the models you're going to be buying when you're there, is, I think it's like £7 or something.
It is,
like £7.
Yeah. 100% worth
it. And it's been £7 since I've went the first time.
So with inflation, like, you're making money.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like, and if you find the assassin, then you're laughing. Find the assassin in that little game thing.
Yeah, it's honestly.
They also have
turned into a bit of an advert for Warhammer World, but it's
their Forge World there as well. You can see all the Forge World stuff.
If this conversation doesn't show you how much of a motivational place for painting Warhammer World is. I don't know. I only mentioned it and we've gone off on a whole conversation about how good it is.
Pretzelmeister, if you can't make it to Warhammer World, don't be disheartened. Please refer to
the first few episodes. There'll be other places, local stores, whatever, that have models on show. Almost, sometimes just seeing other people's models.
There's lots of model expos like all over the world as well, not just specific to Warhammer.
Right. Yeah, that's
I remember, have you ever been to like a model train show or something? Like they're nuts. No, crazy.
No. Yeah, but were you eating like refreshers that? There?
Well, it was full of mostly old people, to be fair.
Yeah, I was going to say, model trains is like, it's more of a Werther's market, I think, than a than refreshers.
Yeah.
Right, James, you've alluded to it. Hobby hacks. This is our closing segment on the show where we share a hobby hack with you. If you have one, please leave it in the comments. James, fire away.
So this one is a freak discovery that saved my bacon on numerous occasions.
It's the way you said it. Save my bacon isn't even that outlandish, but the way you said it just made me laugh. Sorry.
Oh, it's okay. It's all right.
Save my bacon.
So we're talking about spray cans, obviously using them at a decent distance and all of that. So when I was a lot younger, I used a spray can too far away and it was too cold. And you can imagine the model was more texturized than the surface of the moon. It was literally like full of craters, divots, all those kind of things. And obviously back then, once that you've done that, you can't really do much to the model. That's it. You know, I have to strip them and take that off and restart again. So it always bugged me. And I was like, how can I, if I don't have a really bad finish, as in like maybe it's a little bit rougher, and that can happen if the can's sitting for a long time on a shelf and you don't shake it too much before you use it, it comes out way more powdery.
Well, if you read the instructions on the can, it does say to shake it for 2 to 3 minutes.
Yes,
and correct. If you're a real freak like me, you will sit there and start a stopwatch on your phone.
I mean, Olympic can shaking times have never been sort of like a topic or thing that I want to do. But with that being said, if the can has been sitting on a shelf for quite a considerable period of time, and you don't shake it enough, or for example, the temperature is not correct or whatever, or the distance from the object is not correct. Long story short, if you get some form of subtle texture from the spray can, then I have the tool for you. I used to get either a soft or firm, cheap 39p Boots toothbrush that like you wouldn't put near your gums because it would rip into shreds.
Not just any toothbrush, a toothbrush specifically from Boots that specifically costs 39p. Hey,
you can go Poundland, Savers, Superdrug, wherever your retailer of choice.
Your drugstore of choice.
Not a drugstore, George.
It's called a drugstore.
It is a drugstore. Pharmacy, yeah.
He's straight edge, he calls it a pharmacy.
Pharmacy. Sorry. Yeah. But you can go
the to... The American viewers, drugstore.
You can go to any of those and get yourself a really cheap toothbrush that you wouldn't like. You know, if you go on holiday and you forget your toothbrush, you go to shops and you just find like the one you can just use because you need one really quickly.
The one from like the hotel lobby.
Yeah, the hotel lobby, yeah.
Next to like some charm bracelets.
That is the toothbrush that you want to acquire. What you can do with it is you can lightly buff the model. And if it's a soft toothbrush, it won't scratch, like cause like scratching on the model. But what it will do is the movement of the brush, any of those little particles that are like almost stuck to the paint, but they're not properly secured, it will just take them off and actually smooth the finish of the model. Where this goes up to 11 is when you buy an electric toothbrush.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Okay. And then you do it with an electric toothbrush and it almost polishes the roughness off of that badly primed or
I'm just imagining
model.
You there with like your car washing it with like a buffing wheel and you're like, hang on a minute, this is a light bulb moment.
It was a very, very big light bulb moment. It works.
I like the idea of him using the toothbrush on the car.
That is funny. And he gets the buffing wheel for his models.
The wall just explodes. Yeah. But you can use either a really cheap, soft or firm toothbrush, whichever you prefer and whichever you want to use. But when you use an old electric toothbrush, because what happens is an old electric toothbrush runs out of battery or the battery doesn't last as long. So you can just literally keep your old one, don't throw it away or get rid of it. And then whenever you need to, you have that mistake or problem, you just get that out, stick it.
You know what? You can change the head on a toothbrush.
I was going to say, yeah, you can change the head
on a toothbrush. Well, you can do that, yeah.
Use your main one. You're getting dual use.
Use your Oral-B toothbrush that you got for Christmas.
Just
that
get
was
a separate head. Don't confuse the heads, though. Don't do one.
Get like red teeth.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially if you use like, if you're one of those people that uses like the charcoal toothpaste and it's like already black. Yeah, you're looking at the toothbrush.
You're looking at the two heads and you're like, is it Is it Abaddon Black or is it Charcoal Toothpaste? Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah, but no, it does work. And the thing is, because it's you're not going to be physically scrubbing it with the hand action yourself, obviously. If the electric toothbrush is doing it, then only really you've got to just move it without putting force on it. And it does actually work.
Cool. And have you experimented with different compounds in this method?
No.
You're just going in raw with the toothbrush.
Don't get that into it, George. Jesus. Yeah.
I'm imagining like, he's like, what if the toothpaste is slightly abrasive? Yeah, yeah. Oh my God, what if you've got charcoal toothpaste and used it on the model? I bet that would work.
Find out in future episodes. No, we're not
I'm going to test that. No. I'm going to come back. I'm going to come back next week and answers for that.
But as a really good hobby hack, electric toothbrush, if you do get a slightly rough finish on there.
Get some turtle wax.
You don't have to put wax on it. But like, you literally can buff the model and it does work. And it's saved me a few times when I've used that. So I didn't think
he was going when he said the toothbrush thing. I didn't
know where he was going, to be honest. But yeah,
I thought the only thing I could logically think of was that he was going to like flick paint at the model or something.
You can do that, I suppose. Yeah, but I prefer
it's an extra use at your toothbrush. I'll tell you what, if you're doing like Angron or something, you use the electric toothbrush to do that.
Oh yeah, you just put it goes everywhere. Yeah, it just splats everywhere. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, thank you everyone for listening to this week's episode of Paint Perspective. If you could please do us a huge favor and subscribe to us on YouTube if you're watching the video version, or if you're on your audio platform of choice, follow us on Apple Podcasts or subscribe on Spotify. That really, really helps us out and we can keep bringing you these episodes for free every week. Thank you very much. We will see you soon.